You're having a party, and you set up enough chairs and seating for everyone. As the night rolls on, where does everyone end up? In the kitchen. It's In the Kitchen on the next Mind's Eye Radio. You'll hear how composer Samuel Barber loved soup and wanted to be buried with a sprinkling of croutons over his coffin. How memories of simmering soups and clattering pots can trigger a lifetime of love, loss, gatherings, and grief. It's In the Kitchen on the next Mind's Eye Radio. That's Mind's Eye Radio. It's radio within reach. Say the word kitchen, and you're likely to evoke some pretty vivid images in the minds of your listeners. For most of us, kitchens recall golden moments of togetherness with family and friends, places of exotic sights, sounds, and especially aromas. In his wonderful book, Dandelion Wine, Ray Bradbury writes about the kitchen of Douglas Spaulding. "Grandma," he had often wanted to say, "is this where the world began? For surely it had begun in no other than a place like this. The kitchen, without a doubt, was the center of all creation. All things revolved about it. It was the pediment that sustained the temple." You've tuned in to In the Kitchen on Mind's Eye Radio. I'm your host, Greg Willard. In the next hour, the Mind's Eye writers will treat us to a smorgasbord of stories, poems, and essays based upon their experiences in the kitchen. We'll visit the kitchen of composer Samuel Barber, whose cook became a collaborator. We'll discover the difficulties involved in undertaking a change in the family diet. And we'll reminisce about kitchens out of childhood, rooms where all life converged. That and much more. So join us in a look at the many roles the kitchen plays in our lives. The table's set, and we're about to revisit Ray Bradbury's Center of All Creation. While the kitchen is traditionally the place for culinary art, it can also serve as the inspiration for the fine arts as well. That's especially true when circumstances require an individual to tend to her domestic responsibilities while pursuing her creative dreams, as we'll see in writer Sharon Van Sluis's essay, The Kitchen Muse.
The kitchen of my childhood was the usual farm kitchen of a large family, expansive, bustling, the heart of the house. There was the usual procession of meals for the eventual seven of us, of course, but also the intensive canning and freezing, the putting by, of the fruits of our acre garden from late summer through the fall. Strawberries, beans, peas, cucumbers, raspberries, beets, corn, and finally, apples from my grandparents' orchard. The kitchen table was also the spot for the sewing machine, the place for my father to read the paper, the stage for Play-Doh and other messy toys, the laboratory for new recipes, the place for my mother to set her hair, mirror, bobby pins, and bristly rollers in a plastic tub in front of her, on Saturday nights to look nice for church the next morning. The kitchen was the fount of my mother's domestic life, but also it was her muse. Before she married at 22, my mother wanted to be an artist. After high school, she managed to take a technical drawing course and worked for a short time as an architectural draftsperson. After she married and had several children, she followed perhaps what was the only route resembling fine art available to her. She enrolled in the 2-year Famous Artists Correspondence course. "Can you draw this?" the magazine ads would ask, above the simple drawing of a Labrador in profile, or a cat, or a squirrel. Today it would sound bogus. How can you become an artist through the mail? But it was legitimate, and for those like my mother, with tremendous native talent and determination, it was the way to proceed. My mother had talent, a tenacious will, no means to attend art school, and 3 young children at home. Famous artists became her studio class, and it was exactly what she needed, the promise always kept that someone would receive her mailed lessons, comment extensively and intelligently, make many suggestions, mail it back to her, and expect her to improve and respond in a timely fashion. She set up her still life lesson tableau on the big round kitchen table after the kids were finally exhausted and shooed to bed. I was the oldest and sometimes watched her set up. Red crab apples in a shiny stainless steel bowl, the various ingredients and tools of canning them assembled around the lovely fruit, a bottle of cider vinegar, a bag of sugar, cinnamon sticks, wooden spoon, paring knife, cutting board. She would arrange the pieces again and again against a bit of drapery backdrop until it was balanced, pleasing, just right, and then paint and paint late until my father would urge her to bed. In the morning, the pieces would be neatly stacked on the counter, the table cleared and ready for the day's parade. Later, when she had advanced to portraits, she would take Polaroid photos of us for her studies and then paint at the table from the photos. There's the oil portrait of Cassie at age 3, looking over the back of the gray vinyl kitchen chair, her eyes just the right light green, her hair just the right red blonde. There's my great-grandmother peeling apples in a fresh calico apron, her snowy white hair a cloud around her head, the pile of Northern Spy apples on the table in front of her, deep red and slightly striped with green in places, just as you would see them, just as they are. There's the portrait of my great-uncle Jake seated, bent and gnome-like, in a kitchen chair, about to place his dark violin under his chin, his watery blue eyes looking up briefly over his half-glasses. The kitchen was my mother's domestic fount, and prison I came to see, since the work just never stopped, as well as her muse. My mother continued painting beyond her graduation until a short time after the fifth child was born. My mother bore 5 children in 6 years, and there was finally a limit to her energy. She began painting in earnest again after we all left home, many years later, but for a time she nearly stopped. This poem is the image of my mother at the time she knew she must put aside her easel and paints for a while. She is not painting today. My mother is sitting in a small pocket of the afternoon on a beige couch. Her hands are still, her fingertips, soft and precise as sable brushes, are folded toward the inside of her palms. My mother's gray eyes move to the windowpane, following the green shades of trees. The leaves blow like sheaves of paper, the shifting undersides turn up dull silver. She is memorizing the sky, the lines of calm blue between the flashing hues. She remembers the spaces between. She rises and pulls the shade. Her right hand rocks the worn wicker cradle where the new child sleeps. She brushes the fine russet hair with those fingertips and follows the curve of the cheek, pure ivory and smooth as new paint. This is Sharon Van Sluis, Somewhere in the Kitchen for Mind's Eye Radio.
In my kitchen, you'll find comic strips.
Madison writer Kathy Miner.
Oh, sure. You'll also find the usual dishes, utensils, pots and pans, spices and foodstuffs, but over there, next to the doorway. It's not a refrigerator at all, my mother once said. It's a kiosk for newspaper cartoons. I'm an inveterate collector, and since we get both the morning and the afternoon newspaper, I have copious material to work with. I once had an email conversation with a professional cartoonist about the parallels between his work and mine. I've been a poet for more than 40 years, I said, and if I don't read anything else in the newspaper, I always read the funnies. Maybe there's a reason for that. Maybe cartoons and poetry are more alike than we think. They both go to some core emotional truth, some kernel, and they both do it sparely, with a minimum of lines. All unnecessary detail and background have been trimmed away, so you go right to the important stuff. And furthermore, I said, both use a specific instance or depiction in the hope of making contact with others, which is the whole point, the contact and the hope. Whereupon this man, whom I've never met, but whose work is syndicated in hundreds of newspapers, said, "It's perfect. I love it. Cartoons as visual poetry. Couldn't somebody, like, write a dissertation about that?" So the front of my Frigidaire is covered with poetry, I mean comic strips, anchored by a motley crew of magnets. In principle, it's a rotating collection, with old clippings displaced as new ones are added, but a few are more or less permanent residents, and the state of my addiction is such that several years ago, I actually bought a scrapbook in which to save the ones that I couldn't bear to throw away when their terms expired. The Kitchen Collection, it's called. At this point, flipping through the book is like paging through our family's life. There's an old funky winker bean. Two oak leaves are hanging from a branch. One says to the other, "How's your midleaf crisis going?" Responds the second, "I'm coping." Greg Howard's Sally Forth is well represented. Here's a scene between Sally and her daughter Hillary. Sally has a guilty look on her face and one hand behind her back. "Aha! Are you eating a chocolate chip cookie for breakfast?"
"I'm rushed."
"How many times have you told me, 'Eat a good breakfast, Hillary. It's the most important meal of the day.' And now I find my principal role model eating a cookie for breakfast. Arg!"
"I'm lucky she didn't see the root beer."
Two different attitudes toward children starting school are illustrated first by a single-panel Jerry Marcus cartoon showing a mom in curlers and bathrobe sitting on the front step, a magnum of champagne chilling next to her, and a glass in her hand. The mailman is coming up the block. Noticing the woman's blissful smile and the bubbles all around her head, he asks, "Kids go back to school today?" But the flip side of that page shows another aspect of September, this one from the family circus. It's little Billy's very first day of school, ever, and as his mother waves to him from the car, she hears his childish voice asking questions from the past. "Can you take a nap with me, Mommy? Mommy, how do you write 11-teen? "Don't worry, I'll stay right here in the backyard." "I can't tie my shoe, Mommy. I hurt my knee. Will you kiss it?" "I'm afraid of the dark." Over her head arches the thought, "Treat him gently, world, and teach him well." The best humor, I think, probes some deep understanding about ourselves and includes just a touch of ruefulness or outright anger. Here's a Beetle Bailey strip that I've saved for 20 years.
"Halt and identify yourself."
"Lieutenant Sonny Fuzz, 01335506 A Company, 374th Battalion. Blonde hair, blue eyes, 5'8", 146 pounds, age 22, born in Crop Dip, Arkansas. Hobbies, stamp collecting."
Okay, you can pass. Why do some people always tell you more than you want to know?"
That one not only made the refrigerator, but spent close to a decade taped to my dresser mirror besides. It didn't help. I still have a tendency to run on at the mouth. We can ignore doing the house cleaning, but we can't ignore thinking and laughing about it. Two different strips now consigned to the scrapbook deal with the pleasures of laundry. And then there's this from the family circus. The children are answering the door, where a lady with a purse stands on the doorstep. "Mommy's cleaning the bathroom," the little girl offers. "Are you the company we're expecting?" And this one from Wildlife.
"Hanley, who on earth put the terrarium in the blankety-blank refrigerator?"
"Terrarium?
Terrarium?
Terrarium? Oh, you were looking at the cottage cheese."
"You know, we've got to clean this thing out more often."
That one really hit home. I've been infamous over the years for forgetting leftovers on the back shelves of the refrigerator. "Looks like Mom's doing science experiments again," the boys would observe. Like everyone else, my husband and I have gotten older and grayer, and like most everyone else, we're trying to take it with grace and humor. But as Dennis the Menace says to his little friend, "You know, Joey, as your mom and dad get older, they act more and more like the parents on those black and white TV shows." We remember the summer of Woodstock, and we laughed and winced over Jim Borgman's 1994 panel depicting the 25th anniversary concert. A balding, pot-bellied man in a peace T-shirt stands on the soundstage announcing, "People, we have a report of some bad antacid going around." I think it was my mother-in-law who sent us the Six Chicks strip, showing a woman taking modern maturity out of the mailbox and saying to her husband, "It's official. We are stardust. We are golden agers." And then there's Real Life Adventures, this one captioned, "Computers aren't the only thing with random access memory." Honey, do you remember Ed and Donna's phone number?
No, but I remember your social security number and the Munster's address.
Oh, good. That helps. I said before that I'm a poet. I've written at least two poems based on the content of comic strips. One of them was about this strip, Name of Priscilla's Pop, which appeared daily in the Milwaukee Journal during my growing up years. If I'm reading the date correctly, this particular one was published on June 20th, 1977. Priscilla, a little girl, is out on the sidewalk riding her hobby horse when their pastor comes by.
Do you ever make mistakes, Reverend Weems?
Heavens yes, child. Everyone makes mistakes. This is the way we grow as human beings.
In the last panel, Priscilla is approaching her father in his armchair.
Here's my final report card, Pop. I'm going to be a great human being.
I could go on. There are 52 pages in the scrapbook, and with 2 to 4 comics per page, well, you do the math. Not to mention the newest of the new, the even dozen currently enjoying their run on the, kiosk. But I'll close with the very first one in the kitchen collection book. It's from High and Lois, and my mother sent it years ago. Will you put this in the refrigerator for me?
Sure. Where is it?
It's over there, behind the comic strips. With deep gratitude to Tom Baddock, Jim Borgman, Dick Brown, Greg Howard, Bill Keane, Hank Ketchum, John Kovalik, Jerry Marcus, Margaret Schulock, Al Vermeer, Mort, Brian, and Greg Walker, Gary Wise and Lance Aldrich, and many, many others for all the laughs over the years in all the rooms of the house. This is Kathy Miner for Mind's Eye Radio.
One of my favorites of all time is this Rose's Rose. Oh, God, I love her when she morphs into Vicky the Biker Chick.
I just love it.
One day, while rinsing out her mug and spoon in the kitchen sink, writer Fran Rawl remembered seeing her aunt, years ago, going to the pantry to get a dipper of water for a last drink at night. That experience instilled Rawl with a lifelong awareness of the need to conserve water against the possibility that it would someday become scarce. She recalls the early incident and its consequences in her poem Cold Water Thoughts.
They used to sit on a bench outside the farmhouse kitchen door, a pail of water, a basin, and a dipper. People took a drink, washed hands or feet, rinsed dirt off a carrot fresh from the garden. My aunt and my father-in-law both kept a dipper for a private drink, flicking the droplets away and rehanging it on its nail. I wash out my cup and my spoon right after I drink my coffee. Rinsing a few coffee stains dribble down the side, the spoon still a bit sticky from the honey, with cold water. It takes almost a wasted gallon to run hot. My husband, partner, friend never uses them. His special cup sits on the stove away from my snatching hand. They are juxtaposed only during communal dishwashing. How many thoughts do I have washed in cold water? Private, subliminal, not consequential in some ways, but mine alone, not to be intruded upon. The nasty, the wild, the really sweet babies, layered in with the grocery lists, projects uncompleted, the last time I dusted. Floating around, rebounding from harsh realities, hiding in various cracks, bubbling up, unspoken, but not unfelt. Mine alone, untapped, except by me, sorted out as to fantasy, shame, profound, not of consequence. It's busy in there, undisturbed by cold water washing. This is Fran Raw for Mind's Eye Radio.
Thank you.
The kitchen is the room in most houses where children are introduced to adult society, if not at the table, then surely in overheard conversations among parents and other grown-ups. In rare cases, a child's future career may even be influenced by his kitchen companions, as it was for American composer Samuel Barber. Writer Paul Thompson explains.
We don't know who was in the kitchen with Dinah, but we do know who was in the kitchen with Annie Noble, the family cook when young would-be composer Samuel Barber was growing up. Samuel's family was old Irish, while Annie had been brought over from Ireland by his grandmother, and she sang the songs of the old country. Samuel loved to hear the plaintive Irish airs. I imagine him seated at the kitchen table while she sang, as she fixed the hearty dishes of the day, corned beef and cabbage, chowders, roast chicken and duck, mashed potatoes, apple and cherry pie, peaked curds of whipped cream. Perhaps when Annie mixed cake batter, she let him scrape out the bowl. Beyond listening to Annie, young Samuel Barber loved music in general and began playing the piano when he was 6 and composing a year later. His interest in and knowledge of music were reinforced by spending the summers with his mother's sister, Louise Homer, a Metropolitan Opera singer, and her husband, a well-known composer of songs. However, his doctor father and his mother preferred him to focus on athletics and further down the line, perhaps a medical career. When Samuel was 9, he left a note on his mother's dressing table. To begin with, I was not meant to be an athlete, I was meant to be a composer, and will be, I'm sure. Don't ask me to go and play football. Cook Annie was a reader, something of a poet, and had what has been called a darkly humorous imagination. When Samuel was 10, he and Annie worked together to create the first act of an opera, The Rose Tree, Annie writing the libretto and Samuel the music. The work, the manuscript of which survives, concerned a tenor of the Metropolitan Opera Company who vacations in a small 19th century Florida town and falls in love with a local girl. Unfortunately, Annie apparently left the household at this time, and the opera was never completed, although Barber in later life looked for someone who might finish the libretto. Barber never forgot the words of the opening gypsy chorus, according to biographer Barbara Heyman, and in later years would occasionally amuse his friends at parties by singing bits of the song. A wandering gypsy we, the whole wide world is ours. We glance and sing with gladsome glee through the summer hours. We care not for the toilsome way the world so madly follows. Our hearts are light, our lives are gay, and free from care as swallows. Annie may have influenced him in another way. As an adult, he loved good cooking, especially soups. I would like, he once said, to be buried with a sprinkling of croutons over my coffin. At age 14, Barber began attending classes at the newly formed Curtis Institute of Music in nearby Philadelphia, where he was outstanding in piano, voice, and composition. He went on to write songs, operas, symphonies, quartets, and works for piano, never forsaking his Irish roots in melody. His early work included A Slumber Song of the Madonna, based on a text by the English poet Alfred Noyes. Although influenced by developments in atonal and 12-tone music, Barber stuck with harmony and traditional forms. He was an immensely popular composer during much of his career, one of the few able to make a living purely from his music. But he never found composition easy. As his fellow composer John Carlo Minotti stated, he was so gifted, but actually he was a very tormented soul. He was never happy with what he had done. He was only happy when he was composing. When he finished the piece, he could not bear to look at it. And he also suffered a great deal because he went through long periods of dryness. But once he'd gotten into a piece, he would work day and night without stopping. For the general public, Barber's best-known work is the Adagio for Strings, a movement from a larger string quartet written in 1936. Adagio has been featured in several movie scores, including Platoon and Elephant Man. Listeners to National Public Radio voted it one of the 100 top musical compositions of the 20th century, and in the wake of September 11th, it was one of the pieces most often requested by classical radio listeners. Barber's career flourished through the early 1960s. His Concerto for Piano and Orchestra, written for the opening of the Philharmonic Hall at the Kennedy Center, won critical acclaim. That was followed, however, by a fiercely criticized opera based on Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra. That was his last major work. During the remaining 15 years of his life, he suffered from depression, alcoholism, and prolonged creative blocks. In those hard, late years, before his death of cancer in 1981, did Samuel Barber recall a better time, when he was young, and sat in the kitchen listening to Annie sing as she peeled potatoes or stirred the simmering pots on the Black Iron Range? Despite the shadows that closed in on him, the youthful lyrical spirit that responded so ardently to Annie's song endures in his work, and today his romantic lyricism is influencing a new generation of composers. This is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
You're listening to In the Kitchen on Mind's Eye Radio. Coming up, we'll take a look at a heartwarming memoir of the influence of the kitchen on the life of a boy, and then a man, and find out what happens when a mother decides it's time for her family to try a vegetarian diet. I'm Greg Willard. Stay with us.
Julia Child turns 90 this year. 90! Julia. Today, we will do a little something with juniper berries.